Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
And welcome back to the Unforgiving 60 podcast. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host, Ben Pronk.
Hi, Tim.
And we are in RV5, Ben. An RV? What's an RV?
Tim, we go over this every week.
For my benefit, I'm a slow learner.
For Tim's benefit, an RV is a rendezvous, and our version of the RV, we consolidate on questions from listeners, points from previous episodes, and general musings on topical issues.
Now, I'm going to chapter up what we're going to talk about in this RV, because we've got a few things to get through. The first thing is we've just passed Anzac Day, so we wanted to reflect on Anzac Day and our experiences inside it. Second thing is Alex Lloyd, our good friend at Life on the Line podcast, has just done an episode actually interviewing us, and we'll perhaps provide a little bit of commentary on that. And then we also need reflections on the episode of Sabine Bird, the episode of Simon Bailey and Leanne Barron, and then finally we're going to take a couple of questions from listeners. Let's get on with the RV. Okay, Ben, Anzac Day just passed. How did we spend it?
Well, I'm not sure. I think we were both in at the unit. I didn't see you.
It was dark.
It was very dark, pre-dawn. But yeah, we both went in to our former units, and very much appreciate the fact that we're still part of the unit family. It's a very strong bond, I think, in that particular organisation. And it was fantastic, Tim, to see. It seems every year the crowd just gets bigger and bigger, not only at the unit service, but across Australia.
Yeah, and lovely also to see the olds and bolds who come back each Anzac Day and give us an opportunity to catch up with each other, including ourselves in that olds and bolds category. Mm. But also, you know, the talent in the unit and the fact that these junior soldiers are now coming through and they're as impressive now, if not more impressive, than they were in our day.
Two things I love when you come back and that individual who was the bright-eyed, bushy-tailed Rio, the new person in the unit, is now a patrol commander, you know, holding down these really impressive jobs. And it makes you feel sad for the passage of time. And you mentioned we're getting older and bolder. Well, not necessarily any bolder, but it's great to see people mature in their roles within the organisation.
And on that note, one of my reflections, and I love the stillness of the morning, just sitting there and being absorbed in your own thoughts. And I've previously told you the story about walking into my troop office in 1997 and coming across this young Lance Corporal, who actually was my patrol scout, and he was reading the financial review and specifically the share pages, and he asked me the question, you know, what stocks have you got, boss, and you know, can I make some recommendations for you? And I thought it was an absolute setup. Well, I'm delighted to say that I caught up with that particular guy on Anzac Day, and he will now be part of the future leadership of the unit. So from 1997 to 2019, how the worm turns. And in fact, we were laughing. I said, if you had have given me odds on you ultimately making it to the top of your professional tree inside the unit, what would the odds have been? And he said, look, I tell you what, if you had have asked me if I wanted the job way back then or if I were to got it, the answer to both of those things would have been no.
And if you had have followed his stock tips, you probably wouldn't have had to be slaving away.
On the
Unforgiving 60 podcast. The other thing that I always reflect on, we've quoted, in fact, we didn't quote, Elizabeth Armstrong gave us that fantastic George Orwell quote from Shooting an Elephant, which says that a story always sounds clear enough at a distance, but the nearer you get to the scene of events, the vaguer it becomes. That kind of works in reverse as well. When you're in amongst a very busy unit that, you know, relentlessly pursues excellence and has very high standards, you tend to get hypercritical of one another and you tend to be really focused on the things that have gone wrong and what we can do better. When you come back into that environment for things like Anzac Day, you look at just how, in an overall sense, just what a wonderful place it was, what good people, what a fantastic job it was, and really feel quite lucky to have been part of it.
And it's a beautifully curated event, and the whole Garden of Remembrance, the small little area where we have the rock showing all of the names of those people who have been killed on operations and in training, is really particularly special. And I know you've been a CO at the unit, and you've had that great privilege. You probably arrive at an Anzac Day not necessarily knowing all of the things that have gone into making this particular day happen. And funnily, I was talking to my father, who's writing some manuscripts inside the unit at the moment, and he said that the week before Anzac Day, there was one guy who's a volunteer that spent every daylight hour of each day in the week leading up to Anzac Day just getting that whole area right, getting the gardens properly manicured, things properly polished and cleaned. So, you know, that sort of volunteer commitment from former members of the unit, you know, often goes unsung.
And it's pretty cool, the translation of, and it's not just that unit, it's not just the military, but when you get into these habits of trying to go a little further, as our friend James Elroy Flicker would advise us, that it translates into other aspects of your life, that it matters that the gardens present well. It matters that you do the little things well. And I think that's a really good, those kind of habits of excellence can be life-changing.
Mm. And on the beautifully curated Anzac Day dawn service at the unit, the one thing that's really profound is a roll of honour. And if I can perhaps just set the scene here. So two very large screens, and as troopers from the unit read out the names of those people who have been killed on operations and in training, their picture comes up. One of the things that's super profound is the number of people that died in the Black Hawk accident in 1996. 15 SAS members were killed, and of course many others were injured. That list just goes on forever. The other interesting thing that dawned on me as they were going through that long list of 15 members was Andy Constantinides, who was doing his patrol commander's course when I was doing my patrol course, taught me one of the first lessons you learn on the patrol course, which is very simply how to pack your pack. And he was doing it at the time under a tree that is now the Garden of Remembrance. The other fantastic thing is I actually had the opportunity to meet Andy's family on Anzac Day, and I told him a little bit of that story. Quite an incredible moment for me personally. So the other thing with Andy Constantinides, Andy Con, is that he was very small and quite softly spoken. And the simple tips that he gave when involved in that lesson on how to pack your pack, I still carry with me today. It doesn't matter whether I'm going for a bushwalk, I use the same principles. The other really interesting thing about Andy Con is that he demonstrated this quiet professionalism that endeared itself to me. And in my years to that particular point in the military, it had been what I'd been looking for. And I remember walking away from that particular lesson thinking, God, this is just great to be in this unit with these young, empowered professionals who are absolutely inspiring.
Yeah. And you mentioned your father before, Tim, who was also within the unit. And you said you got to catch up for a cheeky whiskey with him on the day. Pretty special moment to share that bond?
Yeah, always is. We have a very simple routine. We like to spend a little bit of time with each other before the service. We go to the service and sit together, and then afterwards we share a glass. And for those that might know a little bit about my father's history, he won a military cross in Borneo, but as part of that action, he unfortunately lost one of his soldiers. They had to carry him off this ridgeline called the Gunong Raya. And Dad, as we poured a whiskey, very simply raises his glass and says to absent friends. He doesn't really need to say anything more than that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Pretty profound.
Yeah. Okay, chapter two, on to the life on... Life on the line?
Onto life onto the line. What Tim's trying to say is that we were extremely fortunate to record, I guess, a joint episode of a podcast with Alex Lloyd, who has got a very long-running, extremely successful, very well put together podcast series called Life on the Line. And if you haven't checked this out, I strongly encourage you to do so.
And we did not feel worthy at all doing that particular episode. When Alex approached us to do the episode, we thought, well, a little bit of the imposter syndrome for 100%. Me personally, having listened to the incredible guests that he's had previously on that podcast, we just didn't feel like we sat naturally with it.
The common connection was my brother Dan Pronk, the average 70 kilo dickhead who is everything but average. He, I think, is one of the higher rating, or his episode is one of the higher rating Life on the Line episodes. I think Alex was hoping to get a bit of that magic out of Tim, and I think he's failed spectacularly, but I really enjoyed the conversation with Alex.
Yeah, it was good, and it draws out things that I think perhaps that we don't draw necessarily out of each other, and we've previously talked about the importance of mission command, and you gave some really great examples on the mission where we boarded and secured the Pongsu, the merchant vessel Pongsu, on how practically we applied that.
That was actually and a very funny to reflect given, you know, how things have panned out and our sort of work together at the moment. But I encourage you to have a listen to the episode. But back at that time, Tim was my squadron commander. I was a young, naive troop commander. And as we went through that operational planning and execution, there are a number of really interesting sort of reflections that we can now make on mission command and the importance of knowing your swim lanes and working in a complementary fashion at those different levels of command towards a common goal.
And we've also been asked, and we will do an episode on planning, briefing and preparation. One of the things that we recently did as part of our wider academic pursuits was we ran a session on wargaming. And certainly there wasn't too much that we did back then, including on that particular mission, Ben, that we didn't absolutely test and adjust through some robust wargaming.
Yeah. And also, I think one of the beautiful things about that work environment was that there were very few shrinking violets. People were comfortable to express their thoughts, propose alternate points of view. And that's something that I see as increasingly important in getting a diverse range of opinions into a plan. And that certainly came out in that particular iteration. And it's something that I think we could do a lot more of across the board, particularly in business environments, having those areas where it's safe to contribute alternate ideas, to come up with crazy plans, to speak what you believe, in ultimately contributing towards the outcome.
And particularly in a mission like that, where there were so many contributing organisations, I mean, multiple state police forces, federal police, a range of intelligence agencies, clearly the Navy, clearly special operations and wider army, all bringing their own specialty to that planning group in order to come up with the best possible plan that we could in order to give ourselves the best chance for mission success that we could.
Good yarn.
Okay, Ben, the next thing to do is reflections on Sabine Bird, the girl that all she does is pedal a bike, simply stated and very understated. Thoughts, reflections on Sabine?
Our first world champion, I think, that we've interviewed.
And world record holder.
Amazing. I am increasingly, and it seems to happen, it certainly happened with Sabine. We'll talk about Leanne Barron in a second, but these incredible people who very willing to share their stories, but almost apologetic about it by saying, look, I'm kind of just a normal person. I'm kind of just doing these things. And from our perspective, from the outside, they're not normal things. These are amazing people. They are living lives less ordinary. They are going that extra yard. And yet they're super humble. And I found that with Sabine.
Let's talk about pain and how she deals with pain. Has it influenced you in your training in the last few weeks, having heard about 729 kilometres in a 24-hour period, and the fact that she's about to ride 4,800 kilometres in the race across America?
My training in the last few weeks, I could probably count the number of sessions on one hand. The thing that blew me away, I love endurance sports. I used to like long distance running. I used to do a bit of marathon, that sort of thing. And I like it for so many reasons. But one of the things that I always found, you know, if you're racing for a certain time, you know what your splits need to be. And you know if you start falling behind that curve, then I always felt this sort of increasing rising panic, that, you know, I'm a bit behind now. How will I go, you know, in the next couple of Ks when I'm even more tired? And I asked Sabine about that, you know, how did you go when you start falling behind the curve? And she sort of looked quizzically at me, which obviously doesn't translate in a podcast, but she says, no, that's okay, I'll just ride faster the next time.
That's right.
Which is this wonderful, you know, I think it's a little Teutonic, it's a wonderful, wonderfully German way of looking at it, but also just goes to show just how hard mentally Sabine is.
Well, the beauty about an endurance activity is you have plenty of time to think about your own misery. Mm-hmm. And I love some of her explanations about keeping busy on the bike, and I'm currently training for a half Ironman, and so I'm doing a little bit of time on the bike. And I've tried to keep busy on the bike to take my mind off pain, and it just doesn't work, let alone ride 729 kilometres in a 24-hour period. I know she's got a couple of upcoming events before she goes to the US and rides from the West Coast to the East Coast.
The Ram, we are certainly really looking forward to seeing how that pans out, and we'll keep you posted on progress on the show.
And good luck to Sabine. Mm. On to Mr. Simon Bailey, the man about the house. Reflections, Ben.
Just brilliant. I really enjoyed our conversation with Simon. You've obviously known Simon for a lot longer than I have, but I've thoroughly enjoyed getting to know him, including through the chat we had on the podcast. I really liked a spin doctor, what might have colloquially have been referred to as a spin doctor, referring to the importance of authenticity in crisis communications. And Simon's a completely authentic guy. Mm. You can certainly imagine that would translate into his work. But it completely resonates with how I think you and I view the way to deal with crisis, particularly on the external comms side of things. And that is, you've got to own it. You've got to display transparency, and you've got to commit to and follow through on fixing what you broke.
That's right. And on the issue of authenticity, he says that there is no place for spin in crisis communications.
Mm. Which is really refreshing. And I think it reflects a maturing of that sort of approach towards media. And you just, I mean, obviously, it's a much more sophisticated audience these days. You cannot get away with the kind of spin that might have happened in the bad old days.
And universally, crises well managed, if you looked at case studies of things done well and things that draw perhaps negative attention to a particular company, there is that common thread where the CEO, managing director, general manager, the leader of the organization owns the problem. Generally, people have some level of empathy, but where they don't own the problem and try and deflect it, there's little tolerance.
Yeah, you're torpedoed. What about you, Tim? What did you take away? I know you've been trying to con-Marie your life and get a bit more sort of organized. Did you get any tips out of that side of the
discussion? Yeah, well, Simon gave us some great tips for ordering certainly our house. He says lay your underwear flat in the drawers. That's done. And don't worry about the hundreds of t-shirts that you've got roughly folded up. Why don't you just put them on the coat hanger? A little bit of that is done as well, although I have to rationalize my t-shirts.
I also want to pick a bone with him. I was always under the impression that if you hung t-shirts, it stretched their little shoulders out. And I'm looking at you as I say little shoulders, Tim. I thought it was bad for the t-shirts, but Simon would know.
Use a clothes peg instead?
Maybe.
we might have to get him back and talk about the value of clothes pegs versus coat hangers.
Versus folding.
Okay, Leanne Barron. Reflections on Leanne.
Well, before I provide my reflections, Leanne, who just an amazing person, obviously anyone who listened to that discussion, I think, would agree, but has we've corresponded since, and she just wanted to come back with a few, what Rupert Hosking might call l'esprit de l'escalier, a few little reflections post the event. The first one, we asked Leanne about the definition of happiness, how she defines happiness, and she ultimately said purpose, and she's come back and said she'd like to add on to that this idea of connection, that she really gets a lot of happiness and joy out of the connection that she experiences with her daughters, her grandchildren, families and friends and colleagues, which I think is a great rejoinder and certainly linked into the idea of purpose and interaction with other human beings.
And I ask her that question on happiness, and for those that have listened to the podcast, and if you haven't, circle back, please. She really takes some time to form an answer on how she defines happiness, which I think is a real credit to her and her commitment to her professional work. I will make a footnote here that I think we all need to take time for us. And she does that with a musical instrument and some songwriting.
Absolutely great. Ukulele songwriting, which is fantastic. But in fact, as part of our correspondence since the episode, Leanne has said that she was very worried she came across as a martyr with that. And I don't think she did at all. I think it was a really genuine discussion about someone who has dedicated her whole life to helping other people. And I think she was a bit taken aback by the idea of, you know, what's happiness for her. But I thought she answered it very well.
Yeah, and she also made the point that, you know, she was very much focused on organisational answers. There's a massive universal problem here with domestic violence. She was focusing on that, and our redirection back to something that was more personal probably was unexpected.
Yeah. In fact, we're pretty bad at podcasting. We sort of jump from what is like not funny, very significant social issues to real fascination with ukulele songwriting that I thought was just wonderful. But I think it does speak to this life that we all live. I mean, it is this real juxtaposition of the frivolous, the important, the self, others, and this whole sort of network of human beings that we live amongst.
Yeah, this complex molecular structure of all of these things, ukulele included.
Love it.
It's an important part of the tapestry
of
each of our lives. That diversity is super important.
It is. And the final thing that Leanne wanted to get across is just a tiny correction to one of the statistics she cited. Leanne mentioned that women are 70 times more likely to be hurt or killed after they leave a violent relationship. She just wanted to correct that. The actual stat is that 50 to 75% of domestic homicides happen at the point of separation or after women leave. So a subtle correction there. I think it's probably immaterial in terms of the fact that this is, for me, an absolutely mind-blowing figure. As I mentioned at the time, I had no idea the magnitude of this problem in our country.
It's super important, and please do listen to that particular episode if you haven't already. I think some of the statistics are profound, and some of the solutions, and certainly the caring that happens from her organisation, the levels of commitment, the levels of contribution are incredible. So you need your purpose, but you also need your ukulele, metaphorically speaking.
What's your ukulele, Tim?
Good question. I do, believe it or not, write some poetry, terrifyingly. In fact, I've got books of poetry that I wrote through the years, through my military years, including some that I wrote whilst on operations.
Yep.
And I do have some desire at some point when I get the time to perhaps fuse those into some form of book.
Musical theatre, mate? A one-man musical sort of recitation of that poetry?
Can I dress up?
I was thinking nude.
Maybe I'll take one of the t-shirts off the hangers and do it like that. I of course, you know, enjoy training. I enjoy being absorbed in my own misery, so that's very important. And actually, one of the things that I've asked myself recently is, what aren't I doing? And the one thing I'm not doing is recreational reading. So I've just ring-fenced 30 minutes a night to pick up one of the half a dozen books that I have beside my bed and just read for 30 minutes in a bit of quiet time. And actually, I've challenged my kids to do the same. So they're now joining me for 30 minutes of quiet time as we decompress the day.
Very cool.
Okay, Ben, now questions from listeners, and actually both of these questions are from fitness professionals. The first question relates to our thoughts of the inclusion of well-being as part of a mission statement?
This is a great question. This is from another Tim, isn't it?
It is from another Tim.
It's not you? You didn't write it?
Well, I'm not a fitness professional, as you well know.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
I'm very much a fitness amateur, perhaps a sub-amateur.
Yeah. This idea of including well-being in a mission statement is a really interesting one, because in many ways you would kind of think that would be implicit.
Mm.
But in so many manifestations, we're seeing it not occurring at all, that people's well-being is kind of this byproduct that can be discarded as long as we achieve the organizational purpose. And patently, that's not sustainable. So I like that idea of explicitly including this concept of our people's well-being as part of the mission. And it comes back to these ideas, I think, of mindfulness that, you know, great, we've got the organizational purpose, we've got a goal we're all working towards. But as anyone who's ever achieved a goal will realize, you know, once you do that, it's like, what's next? And when you accumulate a few of these, you realize that it's not those goals that are the important thing. It's the process of achieving them. So I like that idea of explicitly calling out well-being as part of a mission or a purpose within an organization.
Mm. Well, I mean, mission breaks into two things, doesn't it? Task plus purpose equals mission. And so if well-being is the task, then of course it sits in the mission statement, or the purpose or part of the purpose, then of course it sits in the mission statement. Otherwise, I'd say probably sit it as a principle or sit it in your vision statement. So if your task and purpose as an organisation is all about well-being, then of course you have to have it woven in there.
That's a really good point. And a lot of organisations do have a list of principles or an ethos. So you can still have that mission, that vision, but then you have a series of guidelines as to how you're going to go about achieving any of those different things. And you certainly want to be. You don't want to be doing those at the expense of your individual people, your organisation's well-being.
Mm. Second question is: the fitness professional that is resident with inside an organisation. The question relates to a lack or absence of guidance and direction to the fitness professional, and how they might be better harnessed in order to provide a more meaningful contribution to the betterment of the organisation. And I thought I might start on this because when we raised the East Coast counter-terrorist capability, we put a great deal of emphasis and actually even science into the fitness of the counter-terrorism company that we were raising. And at the time, there was a young physical training instructor, a PTI, called Glenn. And I went to him and I asked him to dissect what did we really need to do to be the best performing counter-terrorist company that we could be. Was it more weightlifting? Was it more running? Did we need to go and lift rocks in the re-entrant? And he did. He went away and put the intellectual rigor into this and came up with a program that, on reflection, not particularly startling, closely resembled a 400-meter athlete. So we needed the explosion, that sort of power component, but also an endurance bit to sustain few minutes of really hard work. And bearing in mind that, as you know, in that counterterrorism environment, you're not just running around clean fatigue with nothing on. You're wearing a 10-kilo set of body armor, two weapons minimum, sledgehammer, charges, ammunition, and all the like. So climbing a ladder or descending a rope, or getting through a door.
Often doing it with a gas mask on.
Absolutely, yeah. So breathing inhibited.
You can take your gas mask off.
I was waiting for that. Thoughts on how other fitness professionals that are resident within organisations might well be engaged?
I love the idea of that link between the physical and the mental. So the physical and then the overall performance. And looking back at special operations, you have a very arduous selection course. There is an element of physicality that you're screening for, but in many ways, what you're screening for is that ability to keep going when things get tough.
Mm.
And that manifests itself in so many different ways other than in the physical domain. And the more we speak to extraordinary people, many of them do have these physical aspects to their life that kind of translate into their ability to achieve difficult goals and to break them down into little chunks. So I think that integration of physical elements into day-to-day business, you know, is a very positive thing. The other thing I think at a team level is that overcoming any sort of shared hardship, everyone in that team doing something hard together and then reflecting on that, you know, recognizing that, is a massively important component of team bonding, developing morale, developing a shared sort of history and lexicon and all that sort of stuff. And so I think there is so much goodness in having some kind of physical component to any team, military, law enforcement, first responder, police, or otherwise, that can, as I said, manifest in all these different other benefits.
So a combat multiplier might be the team building component of exercise as an organization or a subgroup. So if you were a fitness professional, a personal trainer, and you wanted to try and harness better performance out of the organization, perhaps you could simply start there, trying to find those little groups of people to bring together to use fitness as the medium to promote teamwork.
Yep. And I think a lot of organizations do this really well. We work with a number of companies, but we're with an oil and gas company recently that had just had a boxing circuit that morning.
Every Friday. Yeah.
Every Friday. And you know, people from all across the organization get together and, you know, do something physically difficult, good for the soul in many ways to have that kind of, you know, face the fears of human sort of conflict in that controlled environment. But yeah, it really obviously had been an important part of their day. They were speaking about it very positively and reflecting on how it brought disparate elements of that big organization together and gave them a shared experience.
So just changing the angle of the vernacular from fitness to teamwork, but using the vehicle of fitness to get there.
Yeah. And I think, you know, any form, that idea of recognition of a common hardship, any hardship that your team overcomes, it could be, you know, working late for three nights in a row to meet a deadline or to produce a certain report, whatever it might be. I think it's important to recognize that, to actually explicitly call out that, hey, we've just done something tough. We've gone a little further. We've gone above and beyond. Well done, team. You know, and that can, I mentioned before this idea of lexicon that can come from shared experiences. You know, you get these funny little sayings that come out of the hard times that can really help in that team dynamic.
And celebrating success.
Yeah.
We're not very good at doing that.
Because we don't succeed a lot.
In fact, we ran a workshop. It was actually early last year and we walked out and I think that we both thought we could have delivered the workshop a little better. And we immediately went into debrief mode and I think we turned left and pulled out a napkin and a pen and decided how we might do something different in the future. And while we were sitting there, you'll remember that I received an email from the client who said that was the best workshop that we've ever had. Is that the definition of relentless pursuit of excellence? But we need to celebrate success. I don't know. Somewhere in there, there's a balance, isn't there?
I still want to know what the other workshops have had like, but I think we had room for improvement. But yeah, you're right. There's all sorts of perspectives, and I guess it's better to walk out thinking that was awful and get some plaudits at the end of it than to walk out thinking you've killed it and be, I guess, blind to areas where you could improve.
Well, continuous improvement. I think that is just where you should always be, and we certainly do that in everything that we do professionally. We always take the opportunity to debrief each other and debrief our other colleagues, and if there are a smarter way to do it, a better way to do it,
try to find it.
We do try and find it. And the other thing that I think we do well is we ask clients, you know, how could we have delivered that piece of work better for you? Is there a way that could have made it more palatable, more understanding, more understandable?
Yeah, no, I agree. But your point's very valid. It is important to celebrate the small victories and to recognise when things do go okay.
And we've talked also the importance about debriefing before. Well, thanks very much for those questions. We appreciate everyone's feedback, as small as a like on one of our social media pages or a question inside those same pages. But you can also email us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. Other than that, we're on all social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube.
We're still on MySpace.
We're not on MySpace.
I kind of wish we had an ugly MySpace page. Is that still a thing?
I'm not sure, and you know I'm not sure because I am not social media savvy, but I'll raise it with the social media department and see what they come up with.
Good.
Thanks, everyone, for your for your time. We certainly appreciate it. And we'll see you next time on The Unforgiving 60. Cheers.
Every time that I touch your face, it sends me spinning off into space, and I don't know what or where I'll move. And every time that I turn around, you're always drunk, laying on the ground, and I thought I'd be the one to pull you. Where it makes my heart skip, and I'm afraid of what I might do. And every time that you touch my face, it sends me spinning back into space, and I don't know what I'm supposed to prove.
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence on Unforgiving 60, and we want your insights and feedback. And indeed, if you know someone who has great insights to share with us that have a practical difference, then get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. We love speaking to anyone who's been walking on the path less travelled and is generally living the life less ordinary. And if you like the podcast, please rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search at Unforgiving60, that's Unforgiving60. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, you know what to do. See you next episode on The Unforgiving 60.
All you businessmen, politicians, get around.